Hello, everybody. This is Snaky Smut. I am finally getting around to doing historical literature. This is my 1,000 follower present. So thank you all so very much. It means the world to me. I had no idea that it would get this far when I started doing this like 8 months ago, but it's a lot of fun. So 1,000 is a huge milestone. So if you haven't read my post, what I'm going to be doing is hysterical literature. I'm already losing my mind. So what I'm going to do is read one of my favorite books or attempt to read it. While somebody I know controls my Lush 2. If you don't know what a Lush 2 is, it is a sex toy, and it has a remote that can be activated via an app. So while I'm reading this, somebody's going to be controlling that, and we're going to see how far I can get before I officially lose it. so yeah. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to be reading Exquisite Corpse. It is by Poppy Z. Bright. It's one of my favorite books. And yeah, if you actually want to read this book, you totally should, because I don't know how much you'll get out of this. Because like I said, when this thing starts going, it's kind of hard to focus. But we're going to try. So I guess we'll just jump right into it. So this is chapter one. Sometimes a man grows tired of carrying everything the world heaps upon his head. The shoulders sag, the spine bows cruelly, the muscles tremble with weariness. Hope of relief begins to die, and the man must decide whether to cast off his load or endure it until his neck snaps like a brittle twig in autumn. Such was my situation late in my 33rd year. Although I deserved everything the world had heaped upon and the torments after death far worse than any world could threaten, the torture of my skeleton, the rape and dismemberment of my immortal soul, though I deserved all of that and more, I found that I could no longer bear the weight. I realized I didn't have to bear it, you see. I came to understand that I had a choice. It must have been difficult for Christ himself to withstand the agonies of the cross, the filth, the thirst, the terrible spikes raping the jellied flesh of his hands, knowing he had a choice. And I am not Christ, not even by half. My name is Andrew Compton. Between 1977 and 1988, I killed 23 boys and young men in London. I was 17 years old when I began, and 28 when they caught me. All the time I was in prison, I knew that if they ever let me out, I would continue killing boys. But I also knew they would never let me out. My boys and young men were transients in the city. Friendless, hungry, drunk, and strung out on the excellent Pakistani heroin that has coursed through the veins of London since the swinging 60s. I gave them good food, strong tea, and a warm place in my bed, what few pleasures my body could provide. In return, all I asked for was their lives. Sometimes they appeared to give those as readily as anything else. I remember a slow-eyed skinhead who went home with me because he said I was a nice white bloke and not a bleeding queer like most of these others that chatted him up in the pubs of Soho. What he was doing in the pubs of Soho, I cannot tell you. He did not seem inclined to revise his opinion, even as I sucked his cock and slid two greased fingers into his anus. I noticed later that he had a dotted line tattooed in scarlet around his throat, along with the words cut here. I had to only follow directions. You look like a bleeding queer, I told his headless corpse, but young Mr. White England had nothing to say for himself anymore. Whew. I killed most of the 23 by cutting, by severing their major arteries with a knife or a razor after they were insensible from drink. I killed them this way, not out of cowardice or from a wish to avoid a struggle, though I am not a large man. I could have overcome any of my half-starved, drug-addled waifs in a fair fight. I killed them by cutting because I appreciate the beautiful objects that their bodies were, the bright ribbons of blood coursing over the velvet of their skin, the feel of their muscles parting like soft butter. I drowned two in the bath and choked one with the laces of his own Doc Martin boots as he lay in a drunken stupor, but mostly I killed them by cutting. Man, okay. This is not to say that I took them to pieces for pleasure. I found no joy in gross mutilation or dismemberment, not then. It was the subtle whisper and slice of the razor that appealed to me. I liked my boys as they were. Big, dead dolls with an extra weeping crimson mouth or two. I would keep them with me for as much as a week until the smell in my flat grew obvious. I did not find the odor of death unpleasant. It was rather like cut flowers left too long in stagnant water. A heavy, sickish sweetness that coated the nostrils and curled into the back of the throat with every breath. But the neighbors complained, and I would have to invent some excuse or another about my waste disposal backing up or my toilet having overflowed, humiliating and ultimately futile, for it was a neighbor who called the police in the end. I would leave a boy in my armchair when I went to work, and he would be waiting patiently for me when I came home. I would take him into my bed and cradle his creamy smoothness all night. For a day or 2 days or a week, I wouldn't feel alone, and then it would be time to let another one go. I would use a saw to cut them in half at the waist to separate the arms from the torso, to bisect the legs at the knee, and I would wrestle the segments into bulging bags of wet garbage, where their odd angles and powerful stench might be disguised, and leave them out for collection. I would drink whiskey until the flat spun. I would vomit into the basin. Oh, sorry. And saw myself to sleep, having lost at love again. I did not come to appreciate the aesthetics of dismemberment until much later. But for now, I sat in a dank cell in Her Majesty's prison, Painswick, in lower slaughter near the industrial wasteland of Birmingham. These lurid appellations might seem designed to terrify and titillate the soul, and so they do. Look on any map of England and you'll find them along the places called Grimsby, Kettle Crag, Fitful Head, Mouse Hole, Devil's Elbow, and Stool End Farm. England is a country that spares no resonance or descriptive color in its place names, forbidding though they may be. I looked around my cell without much interest. When they brought me in 5 years ago, I knew I was classed as a Category A prisoner. D is the least dangerous. C and B are types you mightn't want to turn your back on. But A was, of course, the ravening killer. The papers had dubbed me the eternal host and invested my unremarkable black and white visage with a dread that bordered on the the contents of my flat had been lovingly inventoried 100 times over. My trial was a legal circus of the vilest sort. The possibility of my escape was deemed highly dangerous to the public. I would remain Category A until the day I died with my eyes fixed on some bleak eternity beyond these four moldering stone walls. I would receive no visitors without approval from the prison governor and close supervision. I didn't care. Everyone I had ever loved was dead. I could be denied education and recreation, but at the time, there was nothing more in life I wanted to do. To learn, no fun I wanted to have. I must endure a light burning constantly in my cell all night, all day, until the outline of it was seared into my corneas. All the better, I thought then, to stare at these hands steeped in blood. Aside from my blazing bulb and my guilty hands, I had an iron bed bolted to the wall and covered with a thin, lumpy mattress, a rickety table and a chair and a pot to piss in. I often reminded myself that at least I had a pot to piss in, but this was cold comfort indeed. Quite literally, so winter mornings in Painswick. I had all these things inside a stone box of cell measuring 3.5 by 4 meters. I wonder how many of Her Majesty's prisoners realized the extra half meter along the wall was a subtle form of torture. As Oscar Wilde was being hounded in chains around the prison yard, he remarked that if this is how Her Majesty treated prisoners, she had no business having any. When I looked at this wall for a long time, which was the only way I could look at it, the wrong geometry began to hurt my eyes. For more than a year, the imperfect square tormented me. I visualized all four walls grinding in and cutting off that dreadful extra half meter, beginning to crumble around me. Then gradually I got used to it, and that chilled me as much as the torment had done. I never liked getting used to things, especially when I'm given no choice in the matter. Once they realized I wasn't going to make trouble, I was given all the notebooks and pencils I wanted. I was seldom allowed out of my cell except for solitary exercise and showers. Sodden, joyless meals were brought to me by silent guards with faces like the judgment of the end of time. I could do no harm with my pencils, save driving one into my own eye, and I wore them down to too dull for that. I filled 20 notebooks my first year, 31 my second, 19 my third. At this time, I was close to true remorse as I ever came. It was as if it had been in a dream that lasted 11 years, and I had woken from it to a world I barely recognized. How had I ever done 23 killings? What made me want to? I attempted to plumb the depths of my soul with words I dissected from my childhood family. Stultifying but hardly traumatic, my sexual history abortive, my career in various branches of the civil service utterly without distinction except for the number of times I was fired for insubordination to my superiors. This done, and little learned, I began to write down the things that interested me now. I found myself with a great many descriptions of murders and sex acts performed upon dead bodies. Small details began to return to me, such as the way a fingerprint would stay in the flesh of a corpse's thigh as if pressed into wax, or a cold thread of semen would sometimes leak out of a flaccid penis as I rolled it around my tongue. The only constant thread running through my prison notebooks was a pervasive loneliness with no discernible beginning or no conceivable end, but a corpse could never walk away. I came to understand that these memories were my salvation. I no longer wanted to know why I had done such things, if it meant I wouldn't want to do them anymore. I put my notebook aside forever. I was different, and that was all. I had known I was different. I could not trudge through life contently chewing whatever cut I found in my mouth. My boys were only another thing that set me apart from the rest. Someone had loved my boys once upon a time, someone who did not have to steal their lives to show love. Each had been somebody's baby once, but so had I, and what good did it ever do me? By all accounts, I emerged from the womb being blue with my umbilical cord wrapped around my neck, and this state and my state of life or death was disputed for several minutes before I sucked in a great gulp of air and began to breathe on my own. The boys I killed must have been strapping infants, but at the time of their death, they were intravenous drug users who shared needles as if borrowing one another's pocket handkerchiefs, who often traded blowjobs for cash or a fix. Of those I took to bed with me while they were still alive, not one asked me to use a condom, and not one expressed concern when I swallowed his sperm. I suspected later that I might have been saving lives by killing some of them. I was never going to moralize, and how could I argue ethics now? There was no excuse. There is no excuse for wanton, random murder, but I came to understand that I didn't need an excuse. I only needed a reason. And the terrible joy of the act was reason enough. I wanted to return my art to fulfill my obvious destiny. I wanted the rest of my life to do as I pleased, and I had no doubt that what that would be. My hands itched for the blade, for the warmth of fresh blood, for the marble smoothness of flesh 3 days dead. I decided to exercise my freedom of choice before I began killing boys. And afterwards, when I couldn't find or have, when I couldn't find or had the energy to go looking, there was another thing I would do sometimes. It began as a crude masturbation technique and ended very near mysticism. And at the trial, they called me a necrophiliac without considering the ancient roots of the word or its profound resonance. I was friend of the dead, lover of the dead, and it was my own first friend and lover. It first happened when I was 13. I would lie on my back and relax my muscles limb from limb, fiber to fiber. I would imagine my organs turning into bitter soup, my brain beginning to liquefy inside my skull. Sometimes I drew a razor across my chest and let the blood run down the sides of my rib cage and let it pool in the hollow of my belly. Sometimes I enhanced my natural pallor with blue-white makeup and later a trace of purple here and there. My own artistic interpretation of lividity, and I tried to escape what seemed a hateful prison of flesh. To imagine myself outside my body was the only way I could love it. After doing this for a time, I began to feel certain changes in my body. I never managed to make my spirit separate completely from my flesh. If I had, I probably wouldn't have come back. But I achieved a hovering state between consciousness and a void, a state where my lungs seemed to stop, pulling in air, and my heart ceased to beat. No, my heart to cease beating. I could still sense a subliminal murmur of bodily function, but no pulse, no breath. I thought I could feel my skin loosening from the connective tissues, my eyes drying before drying out behind blue tinged lids, my molten core beginning to cool. I did this in prison from time to time, without the makeup or razors, of course, and remembering some boy or another, imagining my rancid living body to be his dear dead flesh. It took me 5 years to realize that my talent might be put to another use, and one that would allow me to someday hold a real corpse again. I spent most of my time lying on my bunk. I breathed the heady, meaty smell of hundreds of men eating and sweating and pissing and fucking and living together in cramped, dirty quarters, often with only one chance to shower a week. I closed my eyes and listened to the rhythms of my own body, the myriad paths of my blood, the sweat beating on my skin, the steady pull and release of my lungs, the soft electric hum of my brain and its tributaries. I wondered just how much I would slow it all down, how much of it I could stop entirely. And I wondered if I was successful, whether I would be able to start it all up again. What I had in mind was pretty fine. What I had in my mind was much more advanced than my old game of playing dead. I would have to be dead long enough to fool the guards, the nursing officer, and almost certainly a doctor. But I had read about Hindu... Fuck, I don't even know what that word is. I'm not even gonna try that. Who stopped their own hearts, who allowed themselves to be buried for weeks without oxygen. I knew it could be done, and I thought I could do it. I halved the amount I ate, which had never been much in prison. On the outside, I had been something of a gourmet. I often treated my boys to a restaurant meal before the evening's festivities, though the fare I chose usually too exotic for them. Lamb vindaloo with flaky naan bread, Chinese pork buns, jellied eels, stuffed grape leaves, Vietnamese emerald curry, Ethiopian steak tartare, and the like. Prison food was either gristly, starchy, or cabbagey. I had no trouble leaving half of it on my plate. I knew brains would serve me better than brawn anyway. They always had. Then I felt an emaciated look would add to my task somehow. Off your feet then, Compton, was the only comment I had ever received on the matter. And the guard who delivered had removed my trays. I managed a listless nod, aware that he was trying to be friendly in his fashion. Some of the guards would try to talk to me now and then, presumably so they could go home and tell the wife and kids that the eternal host had spoken with them today, but I didn't want them to remember this particular exchange. One day I deliberately gashed my forehead open on the bars, telling the guard I tripped and banged my skull. Earned me a trip to the infirmary. I was in handcuffs and leg irons the entire time. But I managed to have a look around as the nursing officer swabbed at my wound and stitched it up. "Did you have a Hummer in here?" I asked, referring to an A-wing. A prisoner who had died of heart failure the month before. "Oh, Artie, no, we didn't know the cause of death. So they took him out in an ambulance, autopsied him in lower slaughter, and sent him home to his family, what was left of them. Artie was in for shooting his wife and son, you know, but there was a daughter away at school. I expect she was none too pleased to get daddy back, huh? What did they do with the organs after the autopsy?" I asked. "Partly so you wouldn't remember my asking only one question, and partly out of honest curiosity, as we toss them back in every which way and sew up the trench. Oh, and they saved brains for study. Murderers' brains in particular. I'll wager someone gets yours in a jar in spirits one day, Mr. Compton." "Perhaps," I said, "and perhaps someone would, but not a grinning sawbone in lower slaughter, not if I could help it." The nursing officer took a vial of blood from my arm that day, though I didn't know why. A week later, I was hauled off to the infirmary again, where I learned something that would help me. Learned something that would help me more than I could fathom. "HIV positive?" I asked the pale, sweaty nursing officer. "What does that mean?" "Well, Mr. Compton, maybe nothing." He pinched a slender pamphlet between the tips of his thumb and forefinger and passed it to me. I noticed that he was wearing rubber gloves. "But it means you could develop AIDS." I studied the pamphlet with interest and then looked back at the officer's chagrined face. The whites of his eyes were webbed with red, and he looked as if he had forgotten to shave for a few days. "It says here the virus can be transmitted by sexual contact or through the blood," he noted. "You sewed up my cut last week. Wasn't that dangerous for you?" "Well, I don't He stared at his gloved fingers and shook his head, almost sobbing. No one knows. I brought my shackled wrist up and coughed into my hand to hide a tiny wicked grin. Back in my cell, I read the pamphlet. The odd news article had caught my interest before I was arrested, but I'd never been a great follower of current events. Even so, I remember a mind-boggling assortment of reports, headlines shrilling, like calm assertions that it was a Labor Party conspiracy. I had managed to ascertain that gay men and intravenous drug users were at special risk. Though I wonder whether any of my boys might have been exposed. I never dreamed I could catch it myself. Most of my contact with them had occurred after their deaths, and I assumed any virus would have died with them. But now it looked as though viruses were hardier than boys. Well, Andrew, I told myself, anyone who violates the sweet sanctity of a dead boy's ass cannot expect to get away caught free. Now forget that you may be ill or that you're not ill, and remember only that the virus in your blood makes people afraid of you. And anytime someone is afraid of you, you can use it to your advantage. Oh, my supper tray arrived, and I ate a sliver of boiled beef, a soggy leaf of cabbage, and a few crumbs of dried bread. And then I lay on my bunk and stared at the pale blue network of veins under my skin of my arm and potted my leave of Painswick. I squeezed my eyes shut and turned my face toward the sound of the sea. And the sunlight felt like liquid gold spilling over my cheeks, my chest, my skinny legs, my bare toes dug into the cool, rich soil of the bluff. I was 10 years old on a holiday with my family in the Isle of Man, Andrew Compton, the bright yellow, gorse, and dusky purple. Oh, Heather, your shifting wall, tall enough to hide a small boy lying on his back, refusing to answer. No one in the world knew where I was, or even who I was. I began to feel as if I might fall off the earth and into the boundless blue sky. I would drown in the sea and feeling my arms and legs and straining to breathe. I lost my place. Cloud would taste of mint drops, I imagined, and would be instantly turned my insides to ice. I decided I wouldn't mind falling into the sky. I tried to let go, to stop believing in gravity, but the earth held me fast and wanted to pull me with it. Fine, I thought I would sink into the earth and release my body's nourishing juices into the roots of the heather. I would let the worms and beetles slake away the tender meat packed between my bones. Okay. The syllables were nonsense. This is the meaningless of these words are getting harder. Insistent clang that was accompanying them. Fuck. There was a box made of stone, and the inside of that box was a slab of metal covered with a thin cloth pad. And the top of the pad was thinner. Was an inert thing made of bone. Encased in meat. There's a tap. I was attached to the thing by an invisible tether. Oh, a fragile umbilical cord of ectoplasm and habit. Stretching the, oh my god, all these big fucking words. Oh no. Okay. I'm trying to fucking keep losing my place. No, I refuse to lose yet. Oh shit. Don't turn it down. Don't do that. Oh my god, how did I lose this? Oh, fuck it, I'm just picking. Wait, no, there it is. F. Fuck. F. Muriel? I don't know what that word is. I don't know. Tissue's beginning to disintegrate. Fuck. I heard the hollow rattle of metal against my stone and recognized. It was the drawer of my cell opening. A firearm cocked and footsteps ring as cold as stone. Compton, you try anything funny and I'll put a bullet in your head. What are you fucking playing at? Another voice said, shoot him and see if he moves. Okay, now I know I'm getting stupid because I know this word. Can't figure out how to say it. Laughter, I'm gonna skip it. Laughter unechoed by the first guard. Oh, I'm tired of reading. I fucking steel bracelet snapped around my wrist and a familiar sensation. Then callous fingers checked my pulse and something cold and smooth brushed my lips. A guard called Arnie spoke again and his voice was hushed, almost awed. I think he's dead. Compton's dead. He can't be. He's like a cat. He's got 23 lives. He's not breathing and I don't feel a pulse. We'd better ring for the infirmary. When one is a habitual murderer. And and one tends to also be good and become a good actor. And now I begin to pull off one of the greatest acting jobs of my life, my death. But it didn't feel like acting. A blind succession of cut frames. Ooh, stop action memories. A gurney thundering down a long cinder blocked hallway. My body's strapped down tight, my wrist still cupped. Dangerous enough to merit. Even in death, a smell of medicine and mildew. I reckon. Oh, the prison infirmary. A tiny kneeling pain in the crook of my arm and the sole of my foot. A cold circle of metal on my chest and on my stomach. A tug on my right eyelid. And then a ray of light as sharp and thin as a wire. I remember hearing the voice of the prison governor, a man whose pale, cold stare always drilled through me as if aren't you going to examine the body? We need to know what killed him before we can let him out of here. Oh, sorry, sir. That was the nursing officer whose son got me for sounding more frightened than ever. Andrew Compton received tested. Oh my god. Received. He may have died of AIDS related complications. I'm not qualified to examine him. Well, people don't just up and die one fine morning, do they? They get lesions and things, don't they? I don't know, sir. He'd be the first case who's died here. Most of the HIV-positive prisoners who have been transferred to Wormwood. Compton would have gone there eventually, too. My tethered soul gave a little shudder of delight. If I ended up in Wormwood, I would have had a little chance of getting... I would have had little chance of getting out alive or dead. The prison there was the largest in England with its own hospital and morgue. Well, we can't be messing about with chemical diseases. He'll have to be autopsied in lower slaughter. Ring Dr. Masters to come up here and sign his death certificate. Oh my god. I have seen Dr. Masters probably 5 times. Okay. When each year there's required physical exam. Now here he was again. His hands were as gentle and dry as ever. His breath was smelled like wintergreen and something rotten deep inside. Oh, poor fellow. I heard him murmur fuck too low for anyone else to hear. And they took the key from the guard and uncuffed my wrist. He searched in vain for my pulse and removed my prison uniform. Prodded my belly, rolled me over, and slid the fragile glass gem of a thermometer inside me. I loosened my grip on the world and let my soul go drifting back to the black waves of oblivion. What killed him then was the last thing I heard Dr. Master's soft voice answer. I really have no idea. A clatter of metal and then wheels on a pavement road. There is no paved roads on the prison grounds. I couldn't risk opening my eyes, and even if I wanted to. I heard the clink of tubes and bottles. The static of a radio scanner. The bleat and snarl of traffic. I had made it out of Painswick. Now all I had to do was come back to life, but not yet. Oh, fuck. I was strapped to another gurney. Oh my god, this chapter has 3 more minutes left. I can't even make it through one chapter. Fuck. I might have to call it soon. If I had been breathing, the bag's interior would have grown unbearably hot and humid. Once I had used up the oxygen, like trapped inside, I might have suffocated. Please turn it off! Okay. I give up. Oh, fuck. Okay. Well, I made it 22 pages. And I'm proud of myself for that. So, that's where I'm going to leave it. Because I'm shaking and I can't take anymore. So, thank you for tuning in to me attempt to read an awful and terrible book that's actually really entertaining. And if you like serial killers, you should totally check it out because it's based off Jeffrey Dahmer. So anyway, thank you for tuning in, and thank you for 1,000 followers. Bye!